Despite her resistance to him taking young Victor, not yet 2½, on this trip, she had indeed come to see them off in her silent way. Leto took heart from that. "Could I take the helm?" Romber's rounded face wore a hopeful smile. His unruly, straw-colored hair blew in the freshening breeze. "I've never piloted a big wingboat before. Wait until we reach open sea." Leto looked at the exiled prince with a mischievous smile. "That might be safest. I seem to remember you crashing us against the reefs once." Romber flushed. "I've learned a lot since that time. Common sense, especially." "Indeed you have. Tesha has been a good influence on you." When the mousy-haired Bene Gesserit concubine had accompanied Romber to the docks, her arm in his, she had passionately kissed him farewell. In contrast, Kailia had refused to leave the castle for Leto. At the rear of the V-shaped craft, little Victor giggled, running his hands through the cold spray while the ever-attentive guard captain, Swain Guar, kept watch. Guar kept the boy amused while remaining alert to protect him. 8 men accompanied Leto and Victor on this happy-go-lucky voyage. In addition to Romber and Guar, he also brought with him Thufir Hawat, a pair of guards, a boat captain, and 2 fishermen, Johnny and Dom, friends of Leto's from the docks with whom he'd played as a boy. They would go fishing. They would see the seaweed forests and kelp islands. Leto would show his son the wonders of Caladan. Kailia had wanted to keep her boy locked within the castle, where Victor would be exposed to nothing worse than a common cold or a draft. Leto had listened to her complaints in silence, knowing that the boat trip was not the root of her objection, merely the current manifestation. It was the same old problem. Perhaps Kiara's muttered comments had finally convinced Kailia that Leto was to blame for her unacceptable situation. "I want to be more than an exile," she had shouted during their last evening together, as if that had something to do with the fishing trip. Leto stifled the urge to remind Kailia that her mother had been murdered, her father remained a hunted fugitive, and her people were still enslaved by the Tleilaxu, while she herself was a duke's lady, living in a castle with a fine, healthy son and all the wealth and trappings of a great house. "You should not complain, Kailia," he said, his voice dark with anger. Though he could not placate her, Leto did want the best for their son. Now, under cloud-studded skies, they breathed fresh ocean air and cruised far from land. The wingboat cut through the water like a knife blade through jellied pundi rice. Thufir Hawat stood attentive inside the deckhouse. He scanned the signal-ranging systems and weather patterns, always concerned that some danger might befall his beloved duke. The Master of Assassins kept himself in powerful shape, his skin leathery, his muscles like cables. His sharp Mentat mind could see the wheels within wheels of enemy plots. He studied third and fourth order consequences that Leto, or even Kailia with her shrewd business mind, could not comprehend. In early afternoon, the men cast nets. Though he was a lifelong fisherman, Gianni made it no secret that he preferred a nice big steak for dinner, along with good Caladan wine. But out here, they had to eat what the sea provided. As the nets came up full of flopping, squirming creatures, Victor raced to inspect the beautiful fish with their multicolored scales. Ever watchful, Guar stood conscientiously next to the child, steering him away from the ones with poisonous spines. Leto selected 4 fat butterfish, and Gianni and Dom took them to the galley to clean them. Then he knelt beside his son, helping the curious boy to gather the leftover struggling fish. Together they tossed them overboard, and Victor clapped his hands as they watched the sleek shapes dart into the water. Their course took them into floating continents of interlinked sargasso weed, a greenish-brown desert that extended as far as the eye could see. Broad rivers flowed through breaks in the weed. Flies buzzed about, laying eggs in glistening water droplets. Black and white birds hopped from leaf to leaf, devouring shrimps that wriggled through the warm surface layers. The pungent smell of rotting vegetation filled the air. When the men anchored in the seaweed, they talked and sang songs. Swain Guar helped Victor cast a fishing line over the side, and though his hooks tangled in the seaweed, the delighted boy managed to pull up several silvery fingerfish. Victor ran into the cabin with the slippery fish to show his father, who applauded his son's fishing prowess. After such an exhausting day, the boy crawled into his bunk shortly after sunset and fell asleep. Leto played a few gambling games with the two fishermen. Though he was their duke, Johnny and Dom did nothing to help Leto win. They considered him a friend, exactly as Leto wished. Later, when they told sad stories or sang tragic songs, Johnny wept at the slightest hint of sentiment. Then, far into the night, Leto and Romber sat on deck in the darkness, just talking. Romber had recently gotten a terse, coded message that Kater Pilru had received the explosives, but no word as to how they would be put to use. The prince longed to see what the rebels were doing in the Ixion caverns, though he could not go there. He didn't know what his father would have done in the situation. They spoke of Leto's continuing diplomatic efforts in the Mauritani-Ikazi standoff. It was slow, difficult going. They were faced not only with resistance from the feuding parties, but from Emperor Shaddam himself, who seemed to resent the Atreides' intrusion. Shaddam believed that by stationing a legion of Sardaukar on Grumman for a few years, he had already solved the problem. In reality, it had only delayed the hostilities. With the imperial troops gone now, tensions were mounting again. During a long moment of silence, Leto watched Captain Guar, which brought to mind another one of his friends and fighters. Duncan Idaho has been on Ginaz for 4 years now. He'll become a great swordmaster. Romber stared across the seaweed desert, where furry mermans set up a bubbly chorus, singing challenges to each other across the darkness. And after so many years of tough training, he'll be 1,000 times more valuable to you, you'll see. Still, I miss having him around. The next morning, Leto awoke into a dewy gray dawn. Breathing deeply, he felt refreshed and full of energy. He found Victor still sleeping, the corner of a blanket wrapped around one clenched hand. In his own bunk, Romber yawned and stretched, but gave no sign that he meant to follow Leto out onto the deck. Even on Ix, the prince had never been an early riser. The wingboat captain had already pulled up anchor. At Hawat's direction, did the Mentat ever sleep? They coasted down a wide channel through the seaweed toward open water again. Leto stood on the foredeck, enjoying a silence broken only by the hum of the wingboat's engines. Even the weed-hopping birds were still. Leto noted strange colorations in the clouds out at sea, a moving clump of flickering lights unlike anything he had seen before. From his seat in the midship's deckhouse, the captain increased engine power, and the wingboat raced along, picking up speed. Leto sniffed, detected a metallic scent of ozone, but with an added sourness. He narrowed his gray eyes, ready to call the boat captain. The dense cluster of electrical activity moved against the breezes, darting along low to the water, as if alive. Approaching us. With a thrill of concern, he stepped backward into the deckhouse. Do you see it, Captain? The older man did not take his eyes from the steering column or the phenomenon racing toward them. I've been watching it for 10 minutes, my lord, and in that time it's closed half the distance. I've never seen anything like that before. Leto stood beside the captain's chair. What is it? I've got my suspicions. The captain's expression betrayed concern and fear. He yanked the throttle lever, and the engines roared louder than ever. "I'm thinking we should run." He pointed to the right, away from the approaching lights. Leto brought an edge of ducal command to his voice, stripping away the friendliness he had built over the past day. "Captain, explain yourself." "It's an elecran, sire, if you ask me." Leto laughed once, then stopped. "An elecran? Isn't that just a myth?" His father, the old Duke, had liked to tell stories as the two of them sat by an open beach fire, with the night illuminated only by flickering flames. "You'd be amazed at what's in that sea, boy," Paulus had said, pointing toward the dark water. "Your mother wouldn't want me to tell you this, but I think you should know." He would take a long, thoughtful puff on his pipe and begin his tale. Now the wingboat captain shook his head. "They're rare, my lord, but they do exist. And if such an elemental creature was indeed real, Leto knew what destruction and death it could bring. Turn the boat, then. Set a course away from the thing, maximum speed." The captain slewed them to starboard, churning a white wake in the still water, tilting the deck at an angle steep enough to tumble the men from their bunks below. Leto gripped a cabin rail until his knuckles turned white. Thufir Hawat and Swain Gwar hurried into the deckhouse, demanding to know the reason for the emergency. As Leto pointed aft, the men stared through the mist-specked plaz of the windows. Gwar cursed with colorful language he never used around Victor. Hawat's brow furrowed as his complex mentat mind analyzed the situation and plucked the information he needed from his storehouse of knowledge. "We are in trouble, my Duke." The flashing lights and stormy appearance of the strange creature came closer on their stern, picking up speed, causing steam to boil off the water. The boat captain's forehead glistened with sweat. "It's seen us, sire." He jammed the engine throttle down so hard it nearly broke off in his hand. "Even in this wingboat we can't outrun it. Better prepare for an attack." Leto sounded the alarm. Within seconds the other guards appeared, followed by the two fishermen. Romber carried Victor, who, frightened by the commotion, clung to his uncle. Hawat stared aft, narrowing his eyes. "I don't know how to fight a myth." He looked at his Duke, as if he had failed in some way. "Nevertheless, we will try." Gwar rapped on a bulkhead of the deckhouse. "This boat won't shelter us, will it?" The guard appeared ready to fight anything the Duke identified as an enemy. "An elecran is a cluster of ghosts from men who died in storms at sea," said the fisherman Dom, his voice uncertain as he leaned out of the deckhouse, while the others went out onto the aft deck to face the creature. His brother Gianni shook his head. "Our grandmother said it's the living vengeance of a woman scorned. A long time ago a woman went out during a thunderstorm and screamed curses at the man who had left her. She was struck by lightning. And that's how the elecran was born." It hurt Leto's eyes to look at the towering elecran, a squid of electricity formed by vertical bolts of power and tendrils of gas. Lightning skittered across its surface. Mist, steam, and ozone surrounded it like a shield. As the creature approached the wingboat, it swelled in volume, absorbing seawater like a great geyser. "I've also heard it can only keep its shape, keep itself alive so long as it stays in contact with the water," the boat captain added. "That information is more useful," Hawat said. "Vermilion hells, we're not getting that bloody thing out of the water," Romber said. "I hope there's another way to kill it." Hawat barked a quick order, and the two Atreides guards drew their Lays rifles, weaponry brought aboard at the warrior Mentat's insistence. At the time, Leto had wondered how they could possibly need such firepower on a simple fishing trip. Now he was glad. Dom and Gianni took one look at the threatening knot of energy and scrambled below decks. Swain Gwar, with a glance behind him to make sure Victor was with Romber, raised his own weapon. He was the first to open fire off the stern of the speeding boat, sending out a hot, pulsing blast of light. the energy struck the Alacran and dissipated, causing no harm. Fufir Hawat fired, as did the second Atreides guard.
No effect, the Mentat bellowed into the rising buzz. My Duke, remain in the safety of the cabin.
Even inside, Leto could feel the heat in the air, smell the burned salt and crisped seaweed. Bolts of primal power crackled through the Alacran's fluid body, and it loomed closer to the wingboat, a cyclone of raw power. With a single strike, it could shatter the vessel and electrocute every person aboard.
There is no safety, Thufir, Leto shouted back. I will not let that thing have my son.
He glanced at the boy, who grasped Rhombr around the neck. As if to flaunt its power, one crackling tendril bent down and touched the wooden side of the boat like a priest giving a blessing. Part of the craft's metal trim blasted free as hot sparks danced along every conductive contact. The boat's engine sputtered and died. The captain tried to restart the engines, was rewarded with only rasping, metallic sounds. Gwar appeared ready to hurl himself bodily into the crackling mass, if it would do anything to help. As the boat stopped running, the men continued to fire their laser guns at the core of the Alacran, though with no more effect than a thrown table knife. But Leto realized they were targeting the wrong place. The boat, with no power, was turning, the bow coming around toward the monster. Spotting his opportunity, Leto left the deckhouse and ran toward the wingboat's pointed bow. Hawat cried out to restrain his duke, but Leto raised a hand to forestall his intervention. Audacity had always been an Atreides hallmark. He had to pray the boat captain's folk wisdom was not composed entirely of ridiculous stories.
"Leto, don't do it,"
Rhombr said, clutching Victor tightly to his chest. The boy screamed and squirmed, trying to pummel his way free of his uncle's grasp so he could run to his father. Leto shouted at the monster and waved his hands, hoping to distract the thing, act as bait.
"Here, to me."
He had to save his son as well as his men. The captain was still trying to start the engines, but they wouldn't switch on. Thufir, Gwar, and the two guards hurried to join Leto on the foredeck. The Duke watched the Alacran swell. As it towered like an oncoming tsunami in the air, the creature maintained only a tenuous contact with the salt water that gave it corporeal existence. A lingering static charge made Leto's hair rise, as if a million tiny insects were crawling on his skin. The timing would have to be precise.
Thufir, Swain, point your laser guns at the water below it. Turn the ocean to steam.
Leto raised both arms, offering himself. He had no weapon, nothing with which to threaten the creature. The fearsome Alacran glowed brighter, a crackling mass of primal energy that rose high above the water. It had no face, no eyes, no fangs. Its entire body was composed of death. Hawat barked the order just as Leto dove face first to the wooden deck. Two laser guns blasted the water into froth and steam at the base of the crackling ribbon of lightning. Clouds of white mist boiled up all around. Leto rolled aside, trying to reach the shelter of a high gunwale. The two Atreides guards also opened fire, vaporizing the waves around the flickering creature. The Alacran thrashed, as if surprised, trying to draw itself back down to the seawater that boiled away underneath it. It gave an unearthly cry and struck the boat twice more with spasmic lightning bolts. Finally, when its connection had been completely severed, the Alacran lost all integrity. In a brilliant flashing and sparking explosion, it dissipated into nothing, returning to the realms of myth. A shower of water splattered the deck, tingling and effervescent, as if it still contained a shred of the Alacran's presence. Hot droplets pelted Leto. The stench of ozone made breathing difficult. The ocean became peaceful again, calm and quiet. During the wingboat's subdued return to the docks, Leto felt exhausted, yet content that he had solved the problem and saved his men, and most of all his son.
without a single casualty. Gianni and Dom were already formulating the stories they would tell on stormy nights. Lulled by the drone of the engines, Victor fell asleep on his father's lap. Leto stared out at the water curling past them. He stroked the boy's dark hair and smiled at the innocent face. In Victor's features he could see the imperial bloodlines that had been passed to Leto through his mother. The narrow chin, the intense, pale gray eyes, the aquiline nose. As he studied the dozing boy, he wondered if he loved Victor more than he loved his concubine. At times he wondered if he still loved Kylea at all, especially during the past difficult year, as their life together had grown sour, slowly, inexorably. Had his father felt the same about his wife Helena, trapped as he was in a relationship with a woman whose expectations were so different from his own? And how had their marriage degenerated so far, to the lowest possible level? Few people knew that Lady Helena Atreides had fostered the death of the old Duke, arranging to have him killed by a Seleucid bull. Caressing his son gently, so that he did not wake, Leto vowed never to let Victor be exposed to such great danger again. His heart swelled as if it would burst with love for the boy. Perhaps Kylea had been right. He shouldn't have taken their child out on this fishing trip. Then the Duke narrowed his eyes and rediscovered the steel of leadership. Realizing the cowardice in his thoughts, Leto reversed himself. I cannot be overly protective of him. It would be a serious mistake to coddle this child. Only by facing perils and challenges, as Paulus Atreides had made Leto do, could the young man become strong and intelligent, the leader he needed to be. He looked down and smiled at Victor again. After all, Leto thought, this boy may be Duke someday. He saw the dim gray coastline emerge from the morning shore mist, then Castle Caladan and its docks. It would feel good to be home. Body and mind are two phenomena, observed under different conditions, but of one and the same ultimate reality. Body and mind are aspects of the living being. They operate within a peculiar principle of synchronicity wherein things happen together and behave as if they are the same, yet can be conceived of as separate. Staff Medical Manual, Ginnaz School. In the rainy late morning, Duncan Idaho waited with his classmates on yet another training ground, yet another island in the sprawling chain of isolated classrooms. Warm droplets poured down on them from the oppressive tropical clouds. It always seemed to be raining here. The swordmaster was sweaty and fat, dressed in voluminous khakis. A red bandana cinched around his enormous head made his mahogany-red hair spike upward in rain-dampened points. His eyes were hard little darts, a brown so dark the irises were difficult to distinguish from the pupils. He spoke in a high, thin voice that squeaked out of a voice box buried beneath enormous jowls. When he moved, though, Swordmaster Rivi Denari did so with the grace and speed of a raptor in the final arc of a killing blow. Duncan saw nothing jovial about the man and knew not to underestimate him. The roly-poly appearance was a carefully cultivated feint.
I am a legend here, the huge instructor had said, and you will come to know it.
In the second 4 years of the Ginnaz curriculum, the trainees numbered less than half of those from the first day when Duncan had been forced to wear a heavy suit of armor. A handful of students had already died in the merciless training. Many more had resigned and departed. Only the best can be swordmasters, the teachers said, as if that explained all the hardships. Duncan defeated other students in combat, or in the thinking exercises that were so essential to battle and strategy. Before leaving Caladan, he had been one of the best young fighters for House Atreides, but had never imagined he knew so little. Fighting men are not molded by coddling, Swordmaster Mord Kuhr had droned, one afternoon long ago. In real combat situations, men are molded through extreme challenges that push them to their limits. Some of the scholarly swordmasters had spent days lecturing on military tactics, the history of warfare, even philosophy and politics. They engaged in battles of rhetoric rather than blades. Some were engineers and equipment specialists who had trained Duncan how to assemble and disassemble any kind of weapon, how to create his own killing devices out of the most meager supplies. He learned about shield use and repair, the design of large-scale defensive facilities, and battle plans for large and small-scale conflicts. Now the drumming rain beat its inescapable cadence on the beach, the rocks, the students. Rivi Denari didn't seem to notice a single droplet.
"For the next 6 months, you will memorize the Samurai Warrior Code and its integral philosophy of Bushido. If you insist on being oil slick rocks, I will be rushing water. I will wear away your resistance until you learn everything I am able to teach you."
He shifted his piercing gaze like staccato weapons fire, so that he seemed to address every student individually. A raindrop hung on the end of his nose, then fell away to be replaced by another one.
"You must learn honor, or you deserve to learn nothing at all."
Unintimidated, the ill-humored lordling, Trin Kronos, interrupted the rotund man.
"Honor will win no battle for you unless every combatant agrees to abide by the same terms. If you bind yourself with nonsensical strictures, Master, you can be beaten by any opponent willing to bend the rules."
After hearing that, Duncan Idaho thought he understood some of the brash, provocative actions Viscount Moritani had taken during his conflict with Akaz. The Grummans didn't play by the same rules. Denari's face flushed dark red.
"A victory without honor is no victory."
Kronos shook his head, flinging rainwater away.
"Tell that to the dead soldiers on the losing side."
His friends standing next to him muttered their congratulations at his riposte. Though soaked and bedraggled, somehow they all maintained their haughty pride. Denari's voice grew more strident.
"Would you give up all human civilization? Would you rather become wild animals?"
The enormous man stepped closer to Kronos, who hesitated, then backed away into a puddle.
"Warriors of the Ginaz school are respected across the Imperium. We produce the finest fighters and the greatest tacticians, better even than the Emperor's Sadukar. And yet, do we need a military fleet in orbit? Do we need a standing army to drive off invaders? Do we need a stockpile of weapons so that we can sleep well at night? No, because we follow a code of honor and all the Imperium respects us."
Kronos either ignored or failed to notice the murderous edge in the swordmaster's eyes.
"Then you have a blind spot. You're overconfidence."
Silence hung for a long moment, broken only by the constant tattoo of pattering rain. Denari put a ponderous weight into his words.
"But we have our honor. Learn to value it."
It was pouring again, as it had been for months. Rivi Denari ambled between the ranks of trainees. Despite his bulk, the swordmaster moved like a breeze across the muddy ground.
"If you are eager to fight, you must rid yourself of anxiety. If you are angry at your enemy, you must rid yourself of anger. Animals fight like animals. Humans fight with finesse."
He impaled Duncan with his dart-sharp gaze.
"Clear your mind."
Duncan did not breathe, did not blink. Every cell in his body had frozen to a standstill, every nerve locked in stasis. A wet breeze caressed his face, but he allowed it to blow past him. The constant downpour drenched his clothes, his skin, his bones. But he imagined that it flowed through him.
"Stand without any movement, not the blink of an eye, nor any swelling of your chest, nor the tiniest twitch of a single muscle. Be a stone. Remove yourself from the conscious universe."
After months of Denari's rigorous instruction,
Duncan knew how to slow his metabolism to a death-like state known as funestus. The Swordmaster called it a purification process to prepare their minds and bodies for the introduction of new fighting disciplines. Once achieved, funestus gave him a sensation of peace unlike any previous experience, reminding him of his mother's arms, of her sweet, whispering voice. Wrapped in the trance, Duncan focused his thoughts, his imagination, his drive. An intense brilliance filled his eyes, but he maintained his hold and refused to blink. Duncan felt a sharp pain in his neck, the prick of a needle. "Ah, you still bleed!" Denari exclaimed, as if it were his job to destroy as many candidates as possible. "So too will you bleed in battle. You are not in a perfect state of funestus, Duncan Idaho." He struggled to achieve the meditative state in which the mind commanded its chi energy, remaining in a state of rest while totally prepared for battle. He sought the highest level of concentration, without the contamination of unnecessary and confusing thoughts. He felt himself going deeper, heard Rivi Denari's continuing verbal onslaught. "You carry one of the finest blades in the Imperium, the sword of Duke Paulus Atreides." He loomed over the candidate, who struggled to maintain his focus, his serenity. "But you must earn the right to use it in battle. You have acquired fighting skills, yet you have not demonstrated mastery over your own thoughts. Over-intellectualizing slows and dulls reactions, dampens the warrior's instincts. Mind and body are one, and you must fight with both." The corpulent swordmaster glided around him, slowly circling. Duncan fixed his gaze ahead. "I see every tiny crack of which even you are not aware. If a swordmaster fails, he doesn't just let himself down. He imperils his comrades, disgraces his house, and brings dishonor upon himself." Duncan felt another needle prick his neck, heard a satisfied grunt. "Better." Denari's voice faded as he moved along to inspect the others in turn. As the relentless rain streamed down on him, Duncan maintained funestus. Around him the world grew silent, like the quiet before a storm. Time ceased to hold any meaning for him. "Ayi! Ha!" At Denari's call, Duncan's consciousness began to float, as if he were in a boat in a fast-moving river, and the bulky swordmaster had him in tow. He submerged and continued forward, pushing through metaphorical water toward a destination that lay far beyond his mind. He had been in this mental stream many times. The journey of Partus, as he went to the second step in the sequence of meditation. He washed away all that was old so he could begin anew like a child. The water was fresh and clean and warm all around him, a womb. Duncan accelerated through the liquid, and the boat that was his soul tilted upward. The darkness diminished, and presently he saw a glow above him, becoming brighter. The sparkling light became a watery brilliance, and he saw himself as a tiny mote swimming upward. "Ayi! At Denari's second cry, Duncan surged out of the metaphorical water back into tropical rain and sweet air. He gasped for breath and coughed along with the other students, only to find himself entirely dry, his clothes, his skin, his hair. Before he could express his astonishment, the rain began to soak his clothes again. With clasped hands, the obese swordmaster gazed at the gray heavens, letting raindrops pour over his face like a cleansing baptism. Then he tilted his head down and gazed from face to face, showing supreme pleasure. His students had reached Novellus, the final stage of organic rebirth required before they could begin a complex new teaching. "To conquer a fighting system, you must let it conquer you. You must give yourself to it totally." The loose, wet ends of Swordmaster Denari's red bandana, tied behind his head, drooped down his neck. "Your minds are like soft clay upon which impressions may be made." "We will learn now, Master," the class intoned. The swordmaster said solemnly, "Bushido, where does honor begin? Ancient samurai masters hung mirrors in each of their Shinto temples and asked adherents to look deeply into them to see their own hearts, the variegated reflections of their god. It is in the heart where honor is nurtured and flourishes." With a meaningful glance over at Trin Kronos and the other Grumman students, he continued, "Remember this always. Dishonor is like a gash on a tree trunk. Instead of disappearing with age, it enlarges." He made the class repeat this 3 times before he went on. "The code of honor was more valuable to a samurai than any treasure. A samurai's word, his bushi no ichigon, was never doubted, nor is the word of any swordmaster of Ginaz." Denari finally smiled at them, showing pride at last. "Young samurai, first you will learn basic moves with empty hands. When you have perfected these techniques, weapons will be added to your routines." With his black dart eyes, he looked at them all sharply enough to make them afraid. "The weapon is an extension of the hand." A week later, the exhausted students retired to cots inside their tents on the rugged north shore. Rain spattered their shelters, and trade winds gusted all night long. Fatigued from the rigorous fighting, Duncan settled down to sleep. Tent fittings rattled. Metal eyelets clanked against rope ties in a steady rhythm that made him drowsy. At times he thought he would never be completely dry again. A booming voice startled him. "Everyone out!" He recognized the timbre of Denari's voice, but the big man's tone conveyed something new, something ominous. Another surprise training exercise? The students scrambled out of the tents into the downpour, some clad in shorts, some wearing nothing at all. Without hesitation, they lined up in their usual formations. By now they didn't even feel the rain. Glow globes bobbed in the wind, swaying at the ends of suspensor tethers. Still dressed in khakis, an agitated swordmaster Denari paced in front of the class like a stalking animal. His footsteps were heavy and angry. He didn't care that he splashed in the muddy puddles. Behind him, the engine of a landed ornithopter whined as its articulated wings thumped in the air. A red strobe light on top of the aircraft illuminated the figure of the slender, bald woman, Karsty Toper, who had met Duncan upon his first arrival on Ginaz. Wearing her usual black martial arts pajama, now rain-soaked, she clutched a glistening diplomatic plaque that was impervious to moisture. Her expression looked hard and troubled, as if she were barely able to contain disgust or outrage. "4 years ago, a Grumman ambassador murdered an Akazi diplomat after being accused of sabotaging Akazi fogwood trees, and then Grumman troops engaged in a criminal carpet bombing of Akaz. These heinous and illegal aggressions violated the Great Convention, and the Emperor stationed a legion of Sardaukar on Grumman to prevent further atrocities." Toper paused, waiting for the implications to sink in. "The forms must be obeyed," Denari said, sounding greatly offended. Karsty Toper stepped forward, holding up her crystal document like a cudgel. Rain streamed down her scalp, her temples. "Before removing his Sardaukar from Grumman, the Emperor received promises from both sides agreeing to cease all aggressions against one another." Duncan looked around at the other students, seeking an answer. No one seemed to know what the woman was talking about or why the swordmaster seemed so angry. "Now House Moritani has struck again. The Viscount reneged on the pact," Toper said, "and Grumman..." "They have broken their word," Swordmaster Denari interrupted. "And Grumman agents have kidnapped the brother and eldest daughter of Archduke Armand Akaz and publicly executed them." The gathered students muttered their dismay. Duncan could tell, though, that this was no mere lesson in inter-house politics for them to learn. He dreaded what was about to come. On Duncan's right, he, Resser, shifted uneasily on his feet. He wore shorts, no shirt. 2 rows back, Trin Kronos appeared to be smugly satisfied at what his house had done. 7 members of this class are from Grumman. 3 are from Ekaz. Though these houses are sworn enemies, you students have not permitted such enmity to affect the work of our school. This is to your credit. Topher pocketed her diplomatic plaque. The wind whipped the tails of Dinari's bandana around his head, but he stood as sturdy as an enormous oak tree. Though we have not been part of this dispute, and we avoid imperial politics altogether, the Ginaz school cannot tolerate such dishonor. It shames me even to spit the name of your house. All Grummans, step forward. Front and center. The 7 students did as they were told. 2, including Trin Kronos, were nude, but stood at attention with their companions as if they were fully dressed. Resser looked alarmed and ashamed. Kronos actually raised his chin in indignation. You are faced with a decision, Topher said. Your house has violated imperial law and dishonored itself. After your years here on Ginaz, you understand the appalling seriousness of this offense. No one has ever been kicked out of this school for purely political reasons. Therefore, you may either denounce the insane policies of Viscount Moritani here and now, or be expelled immediately and permanently from the academy. She pointed toward the waiting ornithopter. Trin Kronos scowled. So, after all your words about honor, you ask us to give up loyalty to our house, our families, just like that? He glared at the fat swordmaster. There can be no honor without loyalty. My eternal allegiance is to Grumman and to House Moritani. Loyalty to an unjust cause is a perversion of honor. Unjust cause? Kronos stood flushed and indignant in his nakedness. It is not my place to challenge the decisions of my lord, sir. Nor is it yours. Resser looked straight forward, did not glance at his fellows. I choose to be a swordmaster, sir. I will stay here. The redhead fell back into line beside Duncan, while the other Grummans glared at him as if he were a traitor. Prompted by Kronos, the remaining 6 refused to yield. The Moritani lordling growled, You insult Grumman at your own peril. The Viscount will never forget your meddling. His words were full of bluster, but neither Swordmaster Dinari nor Karsty Topher seemed impressed. The Grummans stood proud and arrogant, though obviously disturbed to be put in such a position. Duncan sympathized with them, realizing that they too had selected a course of honor, a different form of honor, since they refused to abandon their house, regardless of the accusations. If he were thrust into a choice between the Ginaz school and loyalty to House Atreides, he would have chosen Duke Leto without hesitation. Given only minutes to dress and gather their possessions, the Grumman students boarded the Thopter.